Hi, I'm Derek Jensen. This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. My guest today is Melinda Mann. Melinda Mann's a longtime environmental and social justice activist whose, quote, peak trans moment, end quote, 3 years ago, rekindled her deep radical feminism. In response to trans-identified males' demands for unfettered access to women's private spaces, she launched a research project to document the sexual and other violent crimes of males who pose as women, creating a Facebook page called This Never Happens to publicize the results. So first, thank you for your work, and second, thank you for being on the program.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
So right now, there is an art exhibit in quotes, at the San Francisco Public Library that certainly, to my mind, seems to glorify and call for male violence against women.
Yeah.
Can you talk a little bit about that particular art exhibit?
Yeah, lots of people are responding to this, and I kind of couldn't believe it. I actually want to share that I have a fantasy that it's all going to turn out to be a brilliant art project in which these guys show how easy it is to get the entire liberal population to back a outwardly misogynist project. But I don't think that's going to be the case, unfortunately. I don't feel, I wish it was all going to, be shown up to be as absurd as it is. But what they did, they have this group called the Degenderettes, which I understand now call themselves trans dykes because they didn't like the idea that degenderate might actually mean that they were against gender. And they, they put up what they say are their self-defense weapons, baseball bats with barbed wire wrapped around them and a T-shirt. One of their main actors, a guy named Jeremiah Birnbaum, put up a picture of a T-shirt that says, "I punch TERFs," which he has worn out to a dyke march. This is supposed to be an art exhibit that calls attention to the violence against trans women and their need for self-defense. And it even explains on one of the panels, I don't have all the wording right here, but it says something like, why they could justify punching TERFs as opposed to the actual men who commit violence against trans women is that by our, relentless belief in biology and that saying that women don't have penises, by accusing all of us of doxing and harassing them, which I've never seen any evidence of, they actually justify this by saying that it's possible that TERFs have actually caused more trans deaths than the actual men who kill them. So it's quite jarring, I think, to even imagine how the twisted logic that gets them to being able to justify this kind of violence against women.
Let's back up a moment and define some terms. Can you define TERF, and then can you also define trans-identified males or trans women? Can you define all these terms for us, please? Because I don't know that we will understand all of them. We're jumping right into the middle of something.
Okay. Yep. I will gladly back up here. And TERF is trans exclusionary radical feminist. I don't even know how it started, but it's not even clear what radical feminists are supposed to be excluding transgender women from exactly, but it has come to be a slur that means basically, if any woman who does not submit wholeheartedly to what transgender ideology and can be used. It's used to shut down conversations a lot if you ever question any aspect of gender ideology. And And it's used, it's often used in conjunction with the word Nazi, you know, TERFs and Nazis. We can no platform TERFs and Nazis. I've heard young women say that they, you know, they've seen that go by and they didn't really think much about it. So it, I don't know about the origins, but it's certainly come to be just a generalized slur against women. And a lot of times it's leveled at lesbians particularly, because what it turns out, of all the things that males who call themselves women are publicly the most upset about, it would seem that being denied access to lesbian women is right up there towards the top of why they're so very angry at TERFs. It's a generalized slur against radical feminists. The only thing I can think of that we exclude males from is the category of woman, but they often will say that TERFs deny the humanity of trans people, which is to say that we are suggesting that because they are biologically male, that they aren't human. And I have literally never heard anybody ever suggest anything like that. And then trans woman, I sometimes say trans identified male, and sometimes I say trans woman, and mostly I try to just say male. So when I say trans woman, I am talking about a male who poses as or claims to be a woman. So, and a lot of people say trans identified male, for the same thing, somebody who is a biological male, but for whatever it means to them, chooses to live socially as or call themselves a woman.
So you said you use the word trans dyke, and you said mm-hmm. that the group that is putting on this, that created this art exhibit at the San Francisco Public Library, that they call themselves trans dykes. So what is what you're saying is that they are males who are calling themselves lesbians?
Yes, exactly that. So that, you know, the word for those people is heterosexual males, you know, like just like most, you know, like most males. But they've got it turned around so that because they call themselves women, women who say that they, you know, have an orientation towards women as partners should also include them. They have actually a rather creepy slogan. It's it kind of makes my skin crawl. It's trans dykes are good and pure, and I don't even really know what that's supposed to mean. it's pretty strange, but you know, it's the idea that they, that they are just as much of a lesbian as actual lesbians. And it's on this basis that they assert that women whose sexual orientation is towards other females, are bigots for not including them in their, as potential sexual partners.
And there's actually a term that is often thrown around for this called the cotton ceiling.
Yeah, that's right. I first saw that a few years ago when a Planned Parenthood chapter was actually hosting a workshop for trans women, for males, who to come up with strategies to help talk women out of their homosexuality, and you know, and get them to consider having sex with males if the male calls himself a woman. I that was the beginning of one of many dominoes started falling for me when I was looking into all of this, that my beloved Planned Parenthood would actually host such an event. But they did. It's really happening, and it's happening pretty quickly.
So to be clear, these are males who, I mean, they have penises, and
yes,
they are insisting that lesbians who don't want to have sex with them are bigoted
and TERFs and
Nazis.
And to, I mean, again, as this San Francisco Public Library exhibit wraps it all up so neatly that they, you know, their sexual preferences, you know, their exclusion of trans women is somehow contributing to the deaths of these males who they would assert, you know, have these high suicide rates. And so it's, you know, it's, I don't know, it's very hard to even, I suppose that if you're not, haven't been swimming around in this for a few years, it's really hard to imagine how we could have got to this point, you know, that they're literally accusing lesbians of killing them, you know, men accusing women of literally killing them by not being willing to have sex with them.
And one of the exhibits, I've seen pictures of the art set up, and mm-hmm. one of the exhibits has an axe, and there's also a baseball bat, and they are in glass cases, and the caption or title is "In case of turf, break glass." So the clear implication is that if you see a woman who is saying no to males, that you should break the glass, get the axe and or baseball bat, and then do what one does with an axe or baseball bat. So that seems pretty clear to me that it is an open call for violence against women. And I just want to point out to all listeners that this is being hosted by the San Francisco Public Library.
Yeah. Yes, it is. It's being hosted and you know, fairly well defended after a big flurry of you know, of requests to the public library. They did take down the one T-shirt which was looked like a big blood smear on a white T-shirt that said "I punch TERFs." They did concede that maybe that could be misinterpreted as advocating violence against women. You know, it's their argument back is that sometimes you'll even see that TERFs aren't women, and that you know, trans women are real women, and any woman who doesn't accept that is not a real woman. I mean, the threads of thinking here get very, very strange. But the justification is, again, sort of the Nazi justification. You know, killing people is wrong, but killing these horrible, horribly bigoted human beings is somewhat justified as they call it self-defense. They literally say that they are defending themselves.
Well,
you know.
Before we continue, I just want to point out that Robert J. Lifton made very clear that before you can commit any mass atrocity, you have to convince yourself that what you're doing is not an atrocity, but instead a positive good. And mm-hmm. every perperpetrator of atrocity, from individual abusers to the literal Nazis, perceive themselves as the real victims. The Nazis perceive themselves not as committing mass murder and genocide, but instead as purifying the Aryan race. And also, they perceive themselves as having been victimized by the Jews, who, according to the Nazis, you know, stabbed them in the back. And this is all, of course, complete nonsense. We see this in the Declaration of Independence, where the founding fathers were complaining that the Indians were attacking them, as they are, of course, stealing Indian land. So my point is that we need to be, all of us, including the degenderettes, need to be very careful when we claim self-defense as a reason for violence. I'm just throwing that out.
And of course, yeah. I want to say a little bit, if I could, about some of the who these actual people are. I say that they are males who identify as women, but in the particular case, is this okay? Can
no,
I,
please,
can I
please.
Talk a little bit more about these guys? All right. You know, and that again, the category has become this big catch-all, and, you know, maybe somebody thinks about, you know, some young person who has been dressing as a woman, you know, for their whole lives, and, you know, whatever image comes to your mind, you know, I think if you look a little more closely at Jeremiah Birnbaum and Dax Tran Caffey, Scout Tran is what he goes by, these are very privileged, you know, maybe not upper echelon, but very privileged white males who grew up in Silicon Valley in one case and went to elite schools, got MFAs and BFAs, and they've been sort of, you know, mid-level artist types in the Bay Area or on the coasts for quite some time. And they just recently in their careers, I mean, they had careers, art careers as men until their late 30s when, you know, in just the last few years, they've decided to call themselves women and, you know, publicly. And they have this, it's, you know, they're not even anybody who can anchor some, you know, somehow that this was something that they were from childhood or anything like this. It's very, you know, well-to-do or coming from well-to-do families, white males who just recently decided to, you know, put on this cap of being transgender and come out. You know, it's hard not for me to look at that pretty cynically and just decide that this, you know, this is the latest gimmick for them. And yet they very, very, very casually are willing to advocate violence against women and paint themselves as these huge victims, you know, and it's, I find it really offensive on a number of fronts. I mean, not just on the front of feminism, but, you know, that they really, you know, that these are among the privileged class in this country, and that they assert so strongly this newfangled victimhood that then allows them to punch women. And, you know, they've not only do they swing baseball bats, you know, there's YouTube footage right now of one of them at a gun range with his Degenerates t-shirt on, which is an inverted picture of you take a look at the woman's bathroom symbol, you know, with the skirt, they've just turned that upside down and made, instead of the two legs, they've bent one of them down at the knee, so it looks like they're, you know, flipping off whoever's reading it. And, you know, again, there's not a call, there's no big call to be demanded into men's bathrooms. I mean, you might see that go by occasionally, but this is so clearly directed at females. And, you know, and to be at a shooting range and say, as you were saying, that, you know, that this is all self-defense, you know, they have to prepare themselves in self-defense. He's also, Scout Tran is an expert with using a sling. I mean, he's kind of an amazing slingshot, you know, user, and can hit things from quite some distance, you know, with a sling and marbles. This is not a weak guy who's been terribly victimized by any real objective standard, you know, that we could come up with. I don't know his personal life, I'm not claiming to, but I'm just saying from, you know, from a societal standpoint, this is an aggressive, violent, young, privileged male. And that they can turn this all around and say that lesbians are somehow oppressing them, it's, you know, it is scary, and it's a pretty frightening prospect.
Which of these artists is the one who wrote a poem about stealing his sister's underwear and masturbating into it?
Yeah, that's Maya Byrne, whose name is Jeremiah Birnbaum. this wasn't any great sleuthing on my part. Like you said, he's been a musician, you know, for quite some time and has done some recordings and opened for some, you know, low-level or mid-level kind of act. So, yeah, that's him. This is the evidence of their womanhood, right, that masturbating in women's underwear comes up a lot as evidence of their true female nature. That was Maya. Yeah.
I just want to point out, again, that there is an art exhibit being put on in a public space at the San Francisco Public Library that has an axe and a baseball bat that with the intent to show that these should be used against women, which should disqualify it from being held at a public space in the first place. But second, one of the primary artists has publicly written a poem about stealing his sister's underwear and masturbating into it. And that, by itself, I would think, would also disqualify a person from having an art exhibit at a public space. That's pretty messed up.
Pretty bad.
So let's sort of jump to the larger issue. We hear all the time that there are various bathroom bills across the country that mm-hmm. are either set up to make it so males who identify as transgender can use any can so that women are forced to share their showers and bathrooms with them. There are other bills that are attempting to make it so women are not forced to share their bathrooms and locker rooms with males who identify as transgender. And one of the arguments in favor of forcing women to share their bathrooms with them is that males who identify as transgender do not pose and have never, none of them have posed any threat to women under any circumstances. We hear this more or less constantly. So we hear, quote, this never happens. So can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah. The story of my learning about this and probably yours and everybody else's to me is imagining that it can't really be this bad, and if I could just expose the littlest bit, people would at least reconsider, and we could have a reasonable conversation about how to protect the rights of people who are nonconformist in any way, which, of course, I thoroughly support. So I first started, I started looking with just a very few examples of people who had, men who had acted out in any way towards women. One of the early stories I see, and I think it's still up on This Never Happens, is from 2006, where a guy who's, a 220-pound martial arts expert punches a woman in the face because she's in the women's bathroom, and she says something to him like, "Hey, I don't think you're supposed to be here." And he does $50,000 worth of damage to her teeth. He knocks her teeth out, and we're supposed to understand to hear his version of it that it was just inappropriate of her to even question his right to be there. So I remember thinking, wow, if people just know this, they will understand that this is not just a cut and dried issue, and that we need more discussion around it. And I discovered there are a few people who've been tirelessly exposing this for a long time, like Gallus Mag of Gender Trender, and I just thought, okay, I'm going to start a little Facebook page. And I really thought that once I had 20 or 30 examples of this kind of violence, that it would, I fantasized it would be a little bit of a game changer, that anytime I had a conversation about this issue, I could say, well, look, here are these people. And that turned out not to be the case. So we now, have hundreds of examples of males who rape boys, who rape girls, who are serial killers, a number of serial killers. And unfortunately, what I've encountered when I bring this up and show people these examples is just, this is just cherry picking. It's just a handful. There seems to be no number of examples that one could come up with to convince people that men are a problem. So, you know, they bait and switch very quickly. You know, this never happens to, well, okay, maybe it happens occasionally, but the injustice done to trans women by denying them access to women's spaces is so huge that, you know, basically women and children, you know, are going to just need to be sacrificed because, you know, to in the big picture, this is such a greater good, you know. And so, yeah, it happens. It happens more than, much more than I ever thought, and it's happening, as far as I can tell, more often, because as the laws change to enable people to men to go into women's spaces, they're figuring this out. And there's already been a number of examples of men up in Canada going into a woman's shelter, you know, a convicted sex offender, and, you know, demanding that he had the right to go in. He doesn't look like a woman. He doesn't look like he's trying to, but it's Canadian law. So he went in and, of course, did a couple of assaults of women, sexually climbed into bed with one woman. He did not rape anybody, but he, was sexually abusive to several women before getting kicked out. And just recently, we're seeing more guys going into women's bathroom. It just happened in Washington State recently, last month, I think. A guy going in and standing on a toilet and looking over the women's cell and masturbating. And then as the security guard is taking him out, you know, he says, this is my gender identity. You know, people are learning. So there's a combination of things. There is, of course, many, many trans-identified males, people who actually run around, claiming to be women day in and a day out, who commit violent crimes against women. But there's also the added ripple effect of when you decide that any man has the right to claim that he's a woman and thus access women's spaces. Of course, you're giving a blank check to predators to do this. And we're seeing this. Paul Dirks up in Canada has documented, he and I have been doing some documentation. He's much more thorough than I am. He's got hundreds of cases of men abusing women in women's locker rooms and bathrooms. And most don't claim to be trans, in all fairness. They're not necessarily women identified, but he finds that it's about twice as likely to happen in areas where there are laws on the books access, you know, giving males access to women's locker rooms and women's spaces. So, and how is it not only going to extend out from there? There's never an answer, as far as I have heard, about what would be the proper way that we could tell who is truly transgendered versus the people who just want to come in. But back to the original point, even among the people who quote-unquote truly identify as women, there's no evidence whatsoever that their sexual and violent criminal history has any other trajectory than that of other males. In fact, there's plenty of evidence that they have more criminality than other males.
Can you mention that study of, I believe it was done in Norway or Sweden, the long-term follow-up of male criminality?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that one, and this is an interesting point too. It's not really the point I'm always making, but it's that even after transition, and I think it's very important that this was in Sweden, so perhaps the most accepted country with the most acceptance of transgenderism, and I think it's 260 or so people. It's a longitudinal study. No reduction in criminality. And this is after they've transitioned, so this isn't like before they transitioned they became criminals. No, their criminality after they medically transitioned remained the same as other males. So, it's very, every time I mention this, I get this I often get feedback that, like, well, that probably happened because they were so frustrated, and then, fill in the narrative here about how that must be different now. But the truth is that no, even afterwards, they retain the same rate as male as other males. And interestingly, females who undergo the medical transition, or in the whatever version of transition they had in this study, also have increased rates of criminality. So it's not, so they, women increase and males stay the same. It's hard not to point to this as a, you know, not any effective deterrent for, you know, for criminality whatsoever. I also, one of the studies that comes up a lot, like if you've ever heard that 41% of trans women attempt suicide, which is just a ubiquitous figure out there. I see it quoted constantly. It all comes from a large survey that was done and published in 2011, which is all self-reporting, people self-reporting of their suicide attempts, which is, you know, it's kind of a notoriously unreliable report, because, you know, people tend to exaggerate their, all people tend to exaggerate their suicidality because they it's a means of expressing to others how poorly they were feeling at the time. So it's a notoriously kind of unreliable statistic, and it's 41% claim a suicide attempt. But what nobody I ever see mention is that in that exact same study, where they've done this huge self-reporting study of trans people in the U.S., that they also report being incarcerated at much higher rates than anyone else. Extremely high rates, in fact. It's white men who are, you know, there's a lot of different ways to measure it, but have a basically a 4.4% chance of lifetime incarceration. Well, among white males who identify as trans, that's 12% have been in jail or prison. That three times more than the standard rate would be. So it's not just you know, the one study in Sweden. It's their own self-reporting of their own criminality that's three times higher than other males. I mean, it's like 10 times higher than actual females. And yet the cherry picking on the side of people who, you know, promote transgender males as victims and whatnot, always they've managed to find that particular number of the 41%, and yet I almost never hear the bigger number. It's actually 21% of all male to females self-report that they have been in prison or jail. It's like one-fifth, okay? I mean, it's a huge number. It's a huge portion. And, you know, I see that it's almost never mentioned along with, you know, with the things that are mentioned from the very same study.
Another thing that's never mentioned is when they throw out the 41%, which are, of course, again, a self-reported internet poll is useless. I remember talking to Judith Herman decades ago about the gold standard study for the rates at which males rape females. And mm-hmm. one of the things she was talking about is how carefully they constructed the questions to try to not lead people into lead respondents into claiming rape when they had not, and also to frame questions such that the women who had been raped but who didn't call it rape, that they would somehow they would neither dampen nor encourage. And it's a real both art and science to develop those questions such that your results will be meaningful. And of course that does not include self-reporting on the internet, because it's okay, this is a little bit off topic, but when the internet was new, I went to many Crohn's disease support groups since I have Crohn's disease. And it was horrifying. And I never wanted to go back because so many of the cases were so terrible. And then a friend of mine said, Derek, of course, only the people who are having a really hard time with Crohn's are going to go there. So it's a skewed sample. The people who would respond to an internet survey, it's going to be a skewed sample in the first place. So it's just crazy on those levels. But another thing that's never mentioned is that they always act as though that's a trump card that means that because so many of them attempt to commit suicide, that this means that they should be allowed into women's restrooms or some other ad hominem, some completely non sequitur is the word I'm looking for, actually, not ad hominem. And that a couple things. I want to mention three things about suicide. One of them is that the highest rate of suicide in the society is middle-class, middle-aged white males. So you can't really argue that suicidality by itself is a sign of oppression. The next one is that I recently saw a study of the rates of suicidality among attempted suicide among prison guards in California. And then that got me curious. I looked up the rate of suicide attempts by prisoners in California. And the rate of suicide attempts by prison guards is twice what it is of prisoners. And so they would have to argue then that this means that prison guards are more oppressed than prisoners. And then the third thing I want to mention is that there have been studies that have shown correlations between various factors and suicidality. And the strongest correlations are drug and alcohol abuse and diagnosable mental illness, as in Robin Williams having depression, as in Ernest Hemingway having depression. And in no way am I undercutting the horror of those mental illnesses or the desperation that would drive people to suicidality. But my point is that if you're going to do a survey like that, you have to then also, for it to be meaningful, you have to account for what's the rate of drug and alcohol abuse, also what's the rate of diagnosable mental illness. And and those, only when you've separated out those, can you then start to draw any other meaningful conclusions from any of that. And I'm sorry to go on so long, but this has just been something that's been a burr in my saddle for a long time. All that information is just grossly misused.
It is grossly misused. And what I have certainly seen a few stories, a few studies done that are actual, there haven't been all that many long-term follow-ups of transgender people, as far as I can see. Also, a whole lot of people are not really medically transitioning or even necessarily doing it with their documents. So as this whole concept gets more amorphous, it's going to make doing anything like an actual scientific study on people harder and harder and harder. I mean, it used to at least be that it was a diagnosable mental illness, so you could at least then go and look at the outcomes for people who had this diagnosis. And that has been, not done very much at all, really, except for that Swedish study. But I have seen it go by, and often what you'll see is sort of in a relatively small study to start with, 35 young people, I think, in Boston who had medically transitioned, and one commit suicide. And so then compared to a control group, of course, there's probably not in an average of 30 or even 100, people, there's not necessarily going to be a suicide. So, or even in some of the larger ones I've seen, the rate looks like it's doubled, because two trans people committed suicide and one person in the control group committed suicide. So, there might well be some level of suicidality that's connected with it. But what it isn't, what I see with this 41%, as it's used a lot, is first, as you say, it is, it's self-reporting in this huge study, and I've looked at the question. It's just, have you ever attempted suicide? And again, without more nuance, people do tend to overestimate their suicide attempts because it helps, it's a form of expression. It's like saying, yes, I was at one point so depressed that I considered suicide. But then what there never is, and that what they'll do is take some whole other study in which only, you know, 1.5 or 2% of the rest of the population said that they'd ever had a suicide attempt, which is a woefully low number, and they'll just compare two entirely different studies. So they're not, you know, if they were calling 1,000 random people and asking each of them the same question, as you were saying, then, you know, then we might have an answer here, and we might well still see that the suicidal ideation among transgender identified people is higher. But you know what? That's also because the comorbidity of other mental illnesses is higher. So, I mean, or at least that's one explanation for it. So, yeah, turning suicidality into the point of, you know, this the axis upon which it can be demonstrated that this group of people is oppressed, well, it starts to look quite cynical, especially when, as I'm talking about this other self-reported information, self-reported actual incarceration rates, when that's never discussed, you know, when the same exact study that is supposed to be kind of an in-depth look at what's going on in their lives, it never gets highlighted that, oh, and by the way, this is a group of people who self-reports going to prison, you know, three times more than other white males do. Huh, you know, isn't that an interesting part of the entire picture that you would want to have if you were examining who are these people as a group? And yet, you know, it's not. It's the most inflammatory, the thing we can say that makes them, you know, the most sympathetic. And of course, everybody's sympathetic towards people who want to kill themselves. It's a horrible, horrible state of mind to be in, but it's really pretty much never the fault of strangers. And when I say it's cynical, when I say their use of it is cynical, it seems incredibly cynical to me to use something as tragic as a purported suicide attempt to blackmail other people into telling you what you want to hear all the time. It seems fairly childish. And what I always think of is that, you know, no actual oppressed people get to say this. You know, I mean, looking at black people and, you know, and all of the ways that we can show their historical and present day oppression, never is it a big part of the common, you know, parlance, even among left-leaning people, that we should pretty much believe whatever a black person says because they are demonstrably oppressed. That's not how it ever works for anybody, you know, but somehow this interpretation of what oppression is and therefore what they get to demand on the basis of it is almost entirely something that is, you know, fabricated or used cynically by, you know, by people with an express agenda. And I mean, it's this agenda of power. I don't see how it isn't. I'm hard pressed to figure out how that's not a power driven agenda.
So we have about 5 minutes left. And
great.
What, you know, women have struggled. Women struggled 100 years ago in Great Britain do you want to talk about the bathroom struggles in England 100 years ago very briefly?
If you would like to talk about that, that would be great.
Well, all I would say is that women struggled 100 years ago to gain sex-segregated bathrooms in England because they wanted a more robust social life. And this was opposed by males who did not want them to have a more robust social life. And the reason is because women were less likely to be sexually assaulted if they had their own restrooms. And there are many good resources on finding out about this. So we have to put this, so when women say, we want to have our own locker rooms, there is a historical struggle here. And there is a male backlash against this struggle that must be considered part of this discussion. That's all I wanted to say.
I think that's exactly right. Yeah, that this was a remediation. Women having their own private spaces is a remediation that addresses women's oppression. It's not a privilege. It's, you know, it's nothing of the sort.
So how would you sum up our conversation today? What if you could convey like two or three nuggets to people, you know, 30 years later, 40 years later now, oh my God, I'm going to go old. The one thing I remember about Star Wars is use the Force.
So right.
If you could, you know, somebody hears this interview and they could just take away one or two or three nuggets. I heard this interview today. It was about blah, blah. What would they be?
Well, the baseline would be that you can't change your sex, that we are socialized on the basis of our sex from, you know, from birth or even earlier on, and that if ever you're running into males who are claiming that their violence against women is justified for any reason whatsoever, examine that closely. Take a look at why that would possibly be. If young 40-year-old guys swinging baseball bats at a dyke march, it would be hard to imagine that anybody who isn't completely indoctrinated into this way of thinking would think that that was okay, that males intimidating lesbians at a dyke march was a good idea. So carefully examine any time that you see men threatening violence against women.
And then one last thing. So that's great. And then beyond examining, what do you want people to do?
Well, you know, it's interesting right now because I have been off Facebook for a little while. So there is actually on May 26th, women are being encouraged. There's a hashtag, I was called a TERF, or when I was called a TERF, and women are encouraged to write out, why they were called a TERF. You know, I was called the TERF for saying that women don't have penises, for example, and take a selfie with it, and on that day, tweet it to the San Francisco Public Library. So this is kind of an art project going on. They had a panel this last weekend, but they're also having another panel related to the Degenerates art exhibit on May 26th. So that's one concrete soon step. But of course, the bigger step is to always try to keep this discussion going and encourage people to have it with friends and coworkers, which is really, really hard to do in person. But you know, I think there are way more people who are questioning this than feel like they can say it publicly.
Small wonder when you're threatened with baseball bats when you do.
Yes, exactly.
Which is the whole point of the baseball bats, is it not?
I think so. I don't. It's hard to imagine what else, you know. If I see guys, you know, marching down the street wielding weapons, you know, I'm assuming that they believe that it's okay to use them. And if you're doing it at a dyke march, I have to assume that you believe it's okay to use them on actual lesbians.
Well, thank you so much for your work, and thank you for the conversation. I would like to thank listeners for listening. My guest today has been Melinda Mann. This is Derek Jensen for Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.